Good morning, Your Honors. William Taggart on behalf of Appellant Bradley Morrison. I hope I'm going to be real brief, but I never really know that. I have 2 points that I want to make in this brief argument. First of all,
always worries me when someone says I'll be very brief.
I understand that, Your Honor. The word incurred in the phrase paid or incurred in 7430 must mean something different than paid. If Congress had intended
it could simply mean you're going to have to pay, but you don't have to pay yet.
And I think that
you haven't paid it yet, but you are liable for the amount.
I think that that is correct, and I think that that's why Mr. Morrison was correct in his position in this case, because
let me ask you something. Is there any there are assertions, particularly in the motion to reconsider, that there was an agreement that there were two agreements, essentially, that the at the time that Mr. Morrison left the company, that there was an agreement that the company would advance his legal fees and that he would have to pay it back. And there was also an assertion, essentially, that there was an agreement among the four taxpayers that they would split the cost of the representation, essentially pro rata. But is there any writing evidencing either of those agreements?
There is only in part, Your Honor. And you have to understand the way this case evolved. It started out as an audit. And I was representing the clients during the audit indirectly by advising the accountants. I was representing all four of the taxpayers as it evolved into this case. Before the statutory notices were issued, Mr. Morrison was bought out, although the tax dispute existed. I had ongoing relationships with all of the clients before in other matters.
But no retainer agreement.
I represented them everything. I had no retainer agreement on anything because I represented all of them. It wasn't required. In the buyout, I had only peripheral involvement in the buyout. The question of the payment of the fees and the ongoing litigation with the Internal Revenue Service was a very small.
Okay, but you didn't answer my question.
Okay.
What is in writing? You said in part. Just get to that. Where is there anything in writing?
The only written document that relates directly to the engagement is the waiver of conflicts letter that was signed before the petitions were filed.
But there's nothing about who's going to pay anybody anything.
No, because that was just a minor aspect of the buyout arrangement, and that was an agreement made between Nariman Tamorian.
What's the record evidence? Is there a declaration that says that this is what happened?
Yes, there are a number of declarations that say that that's
a declaration precisely from you.
There,
and what else?
There are at least three direct declarations from me, and there are two declarations from Bradley Morrison and one declaration from Nariman Tamorian.
But those were all put in at the reconsideration stage?
I'm sorry?
Those were put in at the reconsideration stage?
The original declaration for the fees was put in with the motion. The issue
But it doesn't say anything about this.
The issue of payment was something that wasn't raised until the opposition to the motion for fees was paid, and it came out of left field, very frankly, because I didn't think it was relevant to anything. If you understand the tax court rules, even to reply to that, you have to file a motion to get permission to file a reply to the opposition for attorney's fees, and it was something that no one was prepared for, and I'm surprised by the decision, which is why I moved for reconsideration, because I think it's clearly wrong. Mr. Morrison did everything except pay the fees. He incurred the obligation when he signed up with counsel, and only a third party agreed to assume that liability as part of the buyout, and as a very small part of the buyout.
So how would you like to see us interpret the term incurred?
That's a difficult question because, as you know, there are insurance cases and
well, that's your chance. I'm asking.
I think that it should be interpreted that any time there is an obligation, whether there's someone that is going to pay them and it's only a secondary obligation, or whether you pay for insurance premiums and then a third party steps in and pays it. I think that those are cases where you are indirectly incurring that liability. You may be paying for it in advance, and I think those should be recovered. The union cases, or the case, I think it's the Krauss case, on or the pension plan did a test case, basically, and paid all of the fees for someone. I think that that's a case where it shouldn't be incurred. They're not incurred by the taxpayer. They're incurred by a large organization that is simply running a test case, paying for one of its clients to litigate a particular issue. But any time there is a fundamental obligation to pay the litigation cost, even though there may be some other payor of it, I think that it is recoverable, provided the...
Well, would you also require that, I mean, there's an assertion here, again, I don't know if there's a declaration that encompasses it, that there was an obligation if Morrison got the money, they had to pay it back to Caspian. Now, suppose that obligation didn't exist. Suppose there was no such obligation. Would that matter?
I don't think that would matter at all. Mr. Morrison qualifies as a small taxpayer for purposes of the recovery of litigation.
But then he would have gotten it twice, essentially. Suppose there was neither the supposed agreement as part of the buyout, nor an obligation to repay. Caspian simply had paid the fees, presumably because it was the corporation he worked for. Then he would essentially be getting a recovery for something that he never paid for.
Well, but
in any sense,
he wouldn't really. He's just getting a little better deal on the buyout than he would have if he has to pay over the money. It was a future obligation.
Well, I understand that, but suppose that weren't. I'm just trying to get at what incurred means.
I think incurred means that if there is an obligation to pay the litigation cost, whether it is primary or fundamental, the obligation exists, and that's all.
Anybody is going to pay them.
Excuse me?
If anyone's going to pay them, it doesn't matter why.
No, it has to be the taxpayer.
That's one thing I wondered about. This statute, unlike EJIA, doesn't actually say that it has to be incurred by the taxpayer. It doesn't say that. EJIA does say it quite directly. But this statute says reasonable litigation costs are reasonable fees paid or incurred for the services. It doesn't say paid or incurred by the taxpayer.
No, but I think that has been interpreted consistently that it is the taxpayer that has to incur them, which is one of the reasons specific language is added to allow for pro bono recoveries, where there was clearly no obligation to pay the cost, where a pro bono clinic took on the obligation to represent a taxpayer, and there was clearly no obligation to pay for it. Can I make one quick comment, because I see we're all using up a lot of time? I think the government in its presentation has misstated the standard that applies for review of litigation costs. I don't think it has anything to do with abuse of discretion.
Is it your contention that the individual Morrison was obligated to repay the corporation or not?
It is my contention, because that was the agreement between Bradley Morrison and Nariman Tamori.
Well, can you tell me in what declaration that appears?
No, I can't. I think it is in my declaration in the motion for reconsideration, but I'm not certain of that.
If there was an obligation to repay, as you say, why would there be such an obligation if that was already negotiated for in the contract, you say, for the buyout? If there was already, in effect, a payment to them as a part of the buyout, why then would there be an additional obligation to repay it?
Because the buyout was completely negotiated between Nariman Tamori and Bradley Morrison before they realized this obligation existed. So they agreed, and there is no written agreement on it, they agreed that that's how they would handle it.
All right. Can I ask one more question?
Certainly.
Assuming we agreed with you up until this point, how has the records that were introduced made it possible to figure out what fees were actually incurred for Morrison as opposed to for everybody?
Well, yes. That was completely broken down in the original presentation, because there was an allocation of all of the charges between, first of all, the four taxpayers, and then secondly, when the two were separated off, Caspian and Morrison's fees were simply treated as a single file and then divided between the two of them.
The tax court never addressed that issue, though, correct?
Excuse me?
The tax court never addressed that
issue. Never addressed in Morrison's case.
I guess your position
Caspian.
Would be that if we were to agree with you on the definition of incurred, we should remand the tax court to address that issue.
I think that that is technically correct, although I would certainly like you to just say that they're wrong.
The tax court also never decided on the substantial justification or anything else.
No, it did not. See, I'm out of time. Thank you.
May it please the Court. My name is Carol Barthel, and I represent the Commissioner in this appeal. I'd like first to address a couple of points that Judge Berzon brought up. The legislation does not explicitly say paid incurred by the taxpayer. It is, however, in the legislative history, which refers to expenses, costs, and fees actually incurred by the taxpayer. We cite that in our brief. And also, as Mr. Taggart remarks, the cases have universally said that the cost must
be. It's fairly striking that Aegis says it specifically in this case.
Yes, it
does not.
It does not say it specifically, but it has been universally.
I'm sorry. I'm not hearing you.
You speak up.
It has been universally interpreted by the courts to mean incurred by the taxpayer. And it is in the legislative history, although not explicitly in the statute. The second point is as to whether the billing costs were broken down among the taxpayers, not according to the amount that the what's in the record. In support for his motion for costs, Mr. Morrison introduced certain billing records, which appear at appendix pages 50 through 56, and all of these records identify the client as Caspian.
What about the question of whether there is, in fact, there's no writing that represents either of the critical agreements. Are there declarations that represent that there were such agreements?
No, Your Honor. There.
What about the Tamorian declaration that's cited in the motion
what
to reconsider?
What the Tamorian declaration says is that in connection with Caspian's termination of Morrison's employment with Caspian and the purchase of Morrison's Caspian stock, Caspian agreed to advance on behalf of Morrison those costs that would be incurred for the benefit of Morrison with respect to the Commissioner's assertion of deficiencies. And in connection with this agreement, Morrison agreed to seek recovery of such costs from the Commissioner and to apply such recovery toward the repayment of any advances Caspian made on behalf of Morrison. That's it as far as what appears in the declarations.
Why isn't that enough?
Yeah.
In connection with Caspian's termination, there is simply just, it's very vague. It's
I mean, what happened?
What's vague about it?
We have no papers. We don't see any we don't see anything from Morrison himself saying this. We only have this very vague and general explanation.
The tax court did not actually reject this, though. It simply refused to consider it, essentially, on reconsideration.
It was, as the tax court said, new and contradictory to what had been
presented. Well, what was contradictory? I don't see anything contradictory at all, actually.
In the motion for costs, in the reply, Morrison had said the agreement regarding Caspian's redemption of Morrison's stock did not expressly address the matter of litigation costs, but instead, all of the litigation costs in connection with all four cases have been paid by Caspian pursuant to an engagement and disclosure agreement. So it's in the motion for costs.
It's general. It just doesn't.
It says that this had nothing to do with it.
It doesn't say that. It says it wasn't expressly addressed, which is essentially what the other person said as well. I really didn't see the contradiction. And I guess what I'm wondering is, I mean, where does that leave us with regard to the tax court? I mean, the tax court, on the other hand, also said he could have introduced this earlier, which he could have. He says he was blindsided and didn't realize it was going to be an issue.
Your Honor, the taxpayer bears the burden of showing that he incurred these costs. And all that we have on the motion for costs is this statement saying it was in the terms of the joint disclosure agreement that Caspian agreed to pay all litigation costs incurred on behalf of the petitioners, not by, but on behalf of, in all four Caspian-related cases, and that under the terms of the joint engagement and disclosure agreement, Caspian is entitled
to. Didn't he say in his motion that he incurred costs?
He says that in his motion, but as the court has repeatedly said, argument of counsel is not evidence.
And the only motion, he said that he incurred costs, correct?
The only evidence in support of that motion was the statement saying that Caspian was paying the costs and the billing statements that listed Caspian as the client.
So as I understand, the tax court judge then said, well, he didn't actually incur any costs because he didn't pay him.
He didn't pay him, nor did he call down upon himself any obligation to pay them.
Well, they didn't say that, though.
In the matter that you just read twice.
I'm sorry?
In the matter that you just twice read, it said that these would be advanced by the corporation and that he would repay them out of the money that he received, right?
It's simply repaying costs that you may receive later on does not mean that you have incurred an obligation. The cases are pretty clear that if, in fact, your repayment is dependent upon your getting the award,
the matter that you read say anything about he had to recover them? Or
no.
No.
Of course not. He couldn't say that.
It said that he was, in effect, obligated to repay them. Was he not?
No, it said that
he advanced and he was obligated to repay.
It said out of any award that he might receive, which is not an obligation. It is simply if you get an award, you must pay them over to us, or you agree to pay them over to us. But this is not a debt. He has not called upon himself a legal obligation to pay anything.
But as the facts developed, he did get an award. And so he'd have to repay it.
He has not gotten an award. He was denied the award of the attorney's fees.
Well, there was a total award, huh?
He won in the tax court below, which meant that he did not have a deficiency. But he has not been awarded his costs in this case.
Let me ask you this. What's your position on how that term should be interpreted? What does it mean?
I would go with the tax courts and the courts that have quoted the tax court in saying that.
Let me hear it again.
That brought down upon himself a legal obligation to pay the cost.
So you think the insurance cases and the union cases are wrongly decided?
No, those are an exception, our statute, in fact, makes the pro bono cases, for example,
that's not an exception. Pro bono. Those aren't pro bono.
Those cases are, this court has compared the union cases to the pro bono cases and the EJIA cases. But in those cases, we don't have the basic problem of a litigant who is discouraged from bringing a meritorious case against the government by the possibility that he will end up winning but having to pay all those costs, which is the purpose of the fee-shifting statute.
Do we know what Caspian got in fees?
I beg your pardon?
Do we know in this record what Caspian got in fees?
I'm sure Mr. Taggart knows, but I don't know.
I would assume what they got was one half of the cost, the other half, i.e. Morrison was going for one half and Caspian was going for the other half. So basically the government's getting windfall out of this. Out of your position.
The government is not getting a windfall, Your Honor, because
Why shouldn't Caspian then be able to recover all of it?
Because Caspian is not the taxpayer in the Bradley Morrison case, Your Honor, and the statute is very clear.
Your assumption is that they were not in fact incurring the other 50%. In other words, there's 100% here, right? The representation is that they agreed to split as 50-50. I assume what happened is that Caspian got 50%. So the other 50%, nobody's going to get on your theory.
Your Honor, this is a waiver of sovereign immunity, which is to be read strictly in favor of the government. And the taxpayer has simply not borne his burden of showing that he was ever under any obligation to pay the attorney's fees.
Why wouldn't Caspian be entitled to the 100% on the theory that it was paying? I mean, if it wasn't pro rata, then and you're relying on the fact that the billing was all to Caspian, then Caspian should get 100%, but I'm sure it didn't get that.
Because Caspian is not the taxpayer in this case. The case
No, I mean in its case, in Caspian's case.
In Caspian's case, Caspian got the award to which Caspian, as the taxpayer in that case, was entitled.
Which was what, 50%, I presume?
That may well be the case. But it is not the taxpayer in the Bradley Morrison case.
But on this set of facts, could they have gone for 100%?
No, I don't believe so, Your Honor.
I'm sorry?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. Because Caspian is not
the just goes into the sky, essentially, even though the costs were actually paid by somebody.
The record says that they were paid by Caspian. Caspian paid everybody's fees in all four cases. It agreed to do that, and if any of the four got an award of litigation costs, they would repay that award to Caspian. That is all that's in the record, Your Honor.
So, I just want to make sure I understand the government's position here. That is, so incurred means more than the taxpayer having paid.
Incurred means something different from the taxpayer having paid.
The taxpayer could show that he incurred costs by showing that he actually paid the attorney's
fees.
Yes,
of course.
Okay, right? So that's one way.
Mm-hmm.
And I gather here your position would be a little bit different if there had been sort of a written agreement between Morrison and his lawyer where he promised to pay.
That could have been put into evidence. Any bills that were sent by the lawyer.
Would that show that he brought down upon himself an obligation to pay?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, now
you add in the fact that Caspian, as part of this buyout agreement, agrees to pay that amount of money for him. Now is it your position then that he's no longer incurred any fees?
That is correct, Your Honor. And under the
I don't understand that at all.
Under the ComServe case, Your Honor, we had a very similar factual situation where we had a severance agreement, and the former employer agreed to pay through its insurance policy any costs in an ongoing SEC investigation. And in fact, that's what happened. And the Eighth Circuit found that because the litigant in that case had not brought down on himself an obligation, he was always protected by the agreement by his former employer to pay those costs. He had not incurred those costs.
So you essentially, as I understand it, have a dual position in this case. One is that the tax court was entitled to not take into account declarations saying that there were these two agreements. And the second is that even if there were these two agreements, even if the facts were exactly as they're represented, still they don't get the money.
That is correct, Your Honor.
But the tax courts never decided the second.
No, it didn't, Your Honor. But
so I don't see how the government can prevail on that. I mean, if they were entitled to have that set of facts considered, they were never considered.
Well, they were not entitled to have that set of facts considered because, as the tax court correctly held, they did not show that this was information that they did not have before. Mr. Tamorian.
No, I understand that, but I'm simply observing that if we thought otherwise about that, then I don't see how we could defer to your view of whether these two agreements would lead to a conclusion about incurring when the tax courts never decided it.
We don't have to go that far because under what was presented simply on the motion for fees and the reply to the opposition to the motion for fees, there was absolutely no basis to award Mr. Morrison fees in this case.
I understand that position, but I'm trying to figure out, would you agree with me that if as to the second position, that we would have to remand to the tax court?
If you thought that, in fact, under this what is a largely hypothetical and argument-based scenario, that might. I imagine that you might decide that, but I don't think that would be correct, Your Honor.
I see. Because for procedural reasons, though.
Procedural and also substantive, because I do not think that even under that somewhat elaborated set of suppositions, there would be an incurrence by the taxpayer of any obligation to pay these fees.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. You had a minute or two for rebuttal.
I want to go back I answered the question you have, but I want to go back to the issue of the standard of review, because I think I misstated it in my reply, at least on the review of substantial justification, and that is, I think, first of all, it's not a discretionary award of attorney's fees. It is a right to attorney's fees if all of the conditions are met, subject to the overriding limitation that there, if the government is substantially justified in its position, that it still don't recover litigation costs. I think if the tax court had made all of those decisions, whether they made them in favor of the government or in favor of the taxpayer, those would be reviewed de novo based on substantial evidence to support the decisions, and not abuse of discretion has very little to do with it.
What it seems to me that in some ways we're coming down to a procedural question of whether the tax court was entitled to deny the motion to reconsider, and how we review a denial of a motion to reconsider under these circumstances.
If I can, the way the motion for reconsideration was decided, I think, was based entirely on Judge Vasquez's conclusion that no new evidence had been presented that he needed to consider, and for that reason denied the motion.
But he actually said that, A, it was contradictory, B, it could have been presented before. That's what the two things he said. It certainly could have been presented before. You have an explanation. I noticed in your memo, in your memorandum, you say you asked them why they were objecting, and they wouldn't say, so you didn't really know what target you were shooting at. Could you have filed a reply brief after they filed their opposition?
I did, I believe, Your Honor, but you have to move tax court in a very short period of time, and then they give you 30 days to reply to it, and I had to scramble around and get the declarations, but I believe I did file a reply when I saw that they raised what was in effect a new issue.
You didn't put in the declarations that you put in later on reconsideration?
No, because I thought it was so clearly wrong in their
position.
I thought it was so clearly wrong that they even raised the issue, because that was a declaration from Eugene Chu, who was the appeals officer, and he misrepresented what was told to him in the first place, and that should have been confidential communication. It was settlement discussion. So, okay. Do you have another question?
All right. Thank you. The matter will be submitted. We appreciate your arguments.